coming up at Boston Public Radio. We'll talk the week ahead in local, state, and national politics. Plus, more and more of us are critiquing our doctors online. Do you and physicians out there, have you been unfairly attacked?
And if you watched the Sweet 16 or the Elite 8, you saw coaches in their colleges making millions. But the players? Not so much. Should those who actually play be paid? And of course, it's April 1st, April Fool's Day for children, juvenile adults, and Marjorie. Yes, she got me again.
Yeah, that's right, Jim. I got you three times in 3 hours.
Fine. Edgar Herrick will join us with the history, the best April 1 pranks, and you can share yours. That's next on Boston Public Radio.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Hailed as a victory for users of generic drugs, India's Supreme Court is denying patent protection to the Swiss pharmaceutical giant Novartis for its blockbuster cancer drug, Gleevec. The ruling ends a six-year legal battle that has been closely watched by pharmaceutical firms, humanitarian aid organizations, and generic drug manufacturers. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports the case highlights the cost difference between foreign pharmaceutical firms looking to protect their investment and local generic competitors supplying the market at a fraction of the cost.
Novartis's drug known as Gleevec, a breakthrough treatment for leukemia in the 1990s, cost about $2,500 a month. The generic version, a couple hundred. When the Swiss drug maker sought a new patent, Indian officials said it was not changed enough to qualify as a new drug. Siding with the patent office, India's Supreme Court effectively ruled against a practice known as evergreening, which critics say allows companies to make minor changes for a new patent, thus denying access as a generic. Novartis said the ruling discourages innovation, but health activists say it provides affordable medicine for the poor. Julie McCarthy, NPR News.
India's fears about the impact recent crimes against women would have on tourism are coming to light in a new survey released today. The country's Associated Chambers of Commerce and Industry has released a report that shows a 25% drop in foreign travelers, especially among women. The study, conducted by 1,200 tour operators from across India, reflects heightened worries after a young woman in New Delhi was gang-raped in December. That was followed by two attacks on foreign female travelers. Authorities in North Texas are stepping up security for elected officials in response to the recent murder of a district attorney and his wife in Kaufman County, southeast of Dallas. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports investigators are not saying whether the killings are connected to two other high-profile slayings of public officials in recent months.
At a news conference, Kaufman County Sheriff David Burns offered few details about the investigation into the slaying of District Attorney Mike McClellan and his wife. The sheriff said only that the murders are unnerving to law enforcement and the community at large.
We're striving to, assure the community that we are still providing public safety, and we'll be able to do that.
The killings follow the January 31st slaying of Kaufman County's assistant DA, and authorities had reportedly been investigating whether that shooting had any connection to the shooting of Colorado's prisons chief at his home south of Denver March 19th. Kirk Sigler, NPR News.
At last check on Wall Street, the Dow was down 32 points at 14,547, and the Nasdaq was off 25 at 3243. This is NPR News.
And from the WGBH Radio Newsroom in Boston, I'm Drew Dawson with the local stories we're following. Caroline Kennedy is expected to be appointed by President Barack Obama to be the new ambassador to Japan. She's being vetted for the post right now. Kennedy, who is 55, was a strong supporter of the president during his campaigns in 2008 and 2012. Retired U.S. Supreme Court Justices Sandra Day O'Connor and David Souter are among the panelists appearing at the Harvard Law School Conference on the Importance of Civics Education. The purpose of the all-day conference today is to explore ways of preparing young people to participate in democracy. Discussions are focusing on new research developments, innovative teaching and learning techniques, and what all Americans should know to be engaged and informed citizens. State conservation officials are asking beachgoers not to disturb piping plover nests as the rare birds return to Massachusetts this spring. The shorebirds come back to Massachusetts' coastal beaches to nest and to raise their young. And in Rhode Island, lawmakers are debating whether to limit strip searches searches and body cavity searches of state prison inmates. The pending bill would require prison guards to have reasonable suspicion to strip search an inmate instead of just speculation or a hunch. Support for NPR comes from the Park Foundation, dedicated to heightening public awareness of critical issues at parkfoundation.org. In sports, the Red Sox begin their season today with the first of three games in New York versus the Yankees. The Celtics are in Minnesota to play the Timberwolves tonight, and the Ottawa Senators come to town to play the Bruins Tuesday evening. Weather for Boston, Worcester, and the Cape, a mix of sun and clouds this afternoon with highs in the upper 50s. It will be cooler inland and a bit windier on the Cape. There's a chance of showers late this afternoon and this evening with temperatures dropping down into the 20s overnight. Sunny and significantly cooler on Tuesday with a high temperature in the 40s. Right now it's 53 degrees in Boston. I'm Drew Dawson. For more news, visit WGBHnews.org.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
You know, it's April 1st. It's April Fool's
yes,
Day.
It is.
And Marjorie is prancing around WGBH as if she has won a Pulitzer. Explain, Marjorie, why you're so gleeful, even though we're going to talk about this at the end of the show.
Because, yeah. Once again, okay. I've in 3 hours, I've fooled you three times. April Fool's
yes,
jokes.
You
and
have.
I've done this for as long as I've known you, which now is about 16 years, Jim. So every year, you take it over and over.
You don't think there's a childish aspect to your behavior in this, Marjorie, or no?
I think what's incredible is that you, Mr. Genius, fall for it over and over and over again. Jim.
What?
I think you had a rip in your
shirt. Okay, fine. I don't think it's going to work anymore. In any case, here to discuss the big political stories of the past week and the week ahead are Michael Goldman. He's a Democratic political consultant. He of Goldman and Associates. Hey, Michael.
How you doing?
Jennifer Nassour is the former chair of the Republican State Committee. Hey, Jennifer.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure.
Would you like to tell Jim he's got spots in his shirt?
No, it's okay.
I was trying to think of a couple
Let's
of good
move
ones.
On.
Okay, so Jennifer, this United States Senate race for John Kerry's seat is just 29 days away, and it doesn't seem to me like it's captured anybody's attention. So does this mean it's a shoo-in for Congressman Markey and the Republicans just get left in the dust?
No, I don't think so. If you remember back in 2009, it was exactly the same way. It was, who cares about the Republican primary going on between Scott Brown and Jack Robinson? You know, it's Democrats, and yeah, it's going to be Mike Capuano is going to be at the top of the ticket, and all of a sudden everything kind of flopped and went the other way. So I think that, you know, what you find is that there's still a lot of voter fatigue from the fall, and now people are looking forward to spring, and I think that this is going to be the next thing that they find. 29
is
still a long time.
Which one is Scott Brown in that field, Jennifer Nassour?
I don't know. I think, you know, at first I was thinking it was going to be Gomez, but then I think Winslow's command performance the other night in the debate was really good and kind of put him out there.
Unfairly, totally subsumed in the coverage of Mayor Menino's announcement he wasn't going to run again. I felt so bad for these people. They get up there and they got almost no coverage.
Well, that's what all the press was talking about. Everyone behind the scenes was talking about Menino not running again as the debate was about to start, which I think took a lot of wind out of both party sails.
By the way, this is the longest period of time that Michael Goldman has ever not
He's
spoken
dying.
And been awake at the same time.
I just waited for her to say April Fool's.
Now, by the way, before you do a response to her, Marjorie said, is it just a walkover for Ed Markey? Ed Markey is only beating Steve Lynch in the most recent poll by 11 points. We both agree Lynch has fabulous ads on television. I think Markey's good, too. This is not quite yet Markey's race, is it, or is it?
Yeah, it is.
Why?
And it's because the people who are going to show up are going to be the people who profile like Markey. I mean, that's always been Lynch's problem. His original campaign theme, which was to say, vote for me because Scott Brown, I'm the guy who can beat Scott Brown, was dead the day after he announced it because Scott Brown dropped out. And subsequent to that time, his biggest problem is Republican races tend to move to the right in the Democratic low turnout Republican primaries, and the Democrats tend to be progressive, as you well know. And so that's been Lynch's real problem. And there's just been neither candidate has gotten any altitude. And when things are even, the guy who's ahead stays ahead. And so I think it's – but I do believe something else, which we're going to get to
What's
in a
that?
Bit, which is, you know, quite frankly, even though they have done everything they can – to say it's not true. I do believe that if Lynch does better than the expectations are, if he only loses by, let's say, 10 points, 12 points.
In the primary.
Boom. He is right in that mayor's race. He is. His ads have been phenomenal. His favorability is very high. His big problem is that the people who are going to vote are ideological voters. Look at the difference between the two ads. Look at the two ads, Salmaggi.
But how could he drop out? I mean,
no, he doesn't drop out.
And then
it's easy. You turn around and you say, I've been overwhelmed by the number of people who have said to me that they want me now to be mayor of Boston. It's the easiest thing.
And he doesn't look ridiculous?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, again, if you look at the two commercials, he has built up his personal favorability by running those personal ads.
Yeah, Markey
has. Markey has not talked about his growing up, you know, as a son of a milkman. He's talked issues because he knows the low number of people voting in the Democratic primary in a late April are going to be issue voters, and they care about issues and not
personal. And then hopefully all of the voters who are voting in the general realize that Markey's commercials are all about the environment, and he is not talking about jobs. He's not talking about why he voted to tax our medical device companies. He's not talking about why he hasn't been out there with our fishermen and growing business in Massachusetts. So that's great. I hope that Markey keeps on doing those commercials that he's doing, because all it does is it helps whatever Republican comes out of that primary, helps them in the general.
Be careful what you wish for.
Who's going to win the primary among the Republicans?
I don't, you know, I mean, I would say instinctually, I would say Sullivan, just because exactly what Michael said. You're talking to 11%. Yeah. Out of those 11%, who's going out to vote? It's going to be the hardcore Republicans.
And he's most conservative.
Now, you know, I think Gomez has done a good job in the debates, and he's getting better. Winslow obviously is out front, but his views are not, they're definitely more general election worthy and not as much in the primary. I think it'll be Sullivan.
Don't you think it's interesting? Jim and Margie just hit it. Their love affair with Brown has always astounded me. But wouldn't you think the Republicans would say, the guy who has the best chance of winning is the guy with the broadest sort of platform? And as you pointed out, no one saw it. He did incredibly well, but he got good play on the debates. You'd think Winslow would be catching fire because they went Brown.
Michael, you could say the same thing about Steve Lynch, who you think is going to get croaked. In the poll that came out the other day, Lynch beats the leading Republican by a far larger margin than does Markey, because he can appeal to unenrolleds who lean to the right, those unenrolleds who lean to the right, and gets quite a few Republicans. By the way, our colleagues have just told us Scott Brown is guest hosting the O'Reilly Factor tonight.
Oh, my goodness.
On Fox News.
Oh, so, that's
Another reason to wash my hair tonight.
Well, in any case,
you know, I was stunned, by the way, when Scott Brown said last week, he told you on the phone that he did not watch the Republican debate. He was out eating dinner in the
actually
night.
Told you too.
Yeah, he did.
Well, the viewership for that thing, even prior to the Menino announcement, was not exactly
colossal.
He's
supposed to be the standard bearer. Shouldn't he have watched the debate? I mean, come on, give the guys a little whatever.
What did it say? You're absolutely
it did,
right.
Yeah, it did.
You
say
lie. Lie
bad.
And say sorry.
Yeah, I think he probably should have lied and said that he saw it.
That's beautiful.
And
that's just lie.
And just read the news reports on it.
Okay, let's move on to one of the big, big issues of the day. At least I hope it is a big issue. First, let's hear Mark Kelly, obviously Gabby Gifford's husband, former astronaut. He's on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace talking about background checks.
5 minutes and 36 seconds is the time it took to fill out one piece of paper. You only have to fill out one side. And for it to be submitted to the National Instant Criminal Background Check System and get an answer. 5 minutes and 36 seconds.
And on the same day, Arizona Senator Jeff Flake was on NBC with Chuck Todd and said that he and other Republicans want some kind of background checks, but not universal.
I've actually introduced legislation with Senator Graham, Senator Begich, and Senator Pryor with regard to mental health issues. We do need to strengthen the background check system. But universal background checks, I think, is a bridge too far for most of us.
So, Jennifer, you're the Massachusetts Republican. We presume a little bit more liberal on this kind of thing. A lot of your colleagues elsewhere outside the state are not big on background checks, even though 90% of the public wants them. I mean, what do you do about this?
I mean, I think that, you know, in the world of where the public is, you have to go along with it. You have to look at what just happened in Newtown. You have to look at all of the violence that goes on around the country and say that, you know, if it only takes 5 minutes, I think that there has to be some common ground and you have to have a give and take. Mm-hmm. And so if you still want to support having the rifles and the automatic weapons and all that, then it becomes having a background check for it. Well, then maybe that's the give and take that we're looking for. And I think ultimately they'll come to some good decision. I'm not sure. In Massachusetts, we have it.
You think there's going to be a national okay by the Republicans on background checks? You really do?
I don't know if they're going to say, well, because also you have Democrats. You have the Blue Dog Democrats. You have the Democrats that are, you know, on the NRA side all the time.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're willing to give in and have the background checks there. Again, it's a give and take, right? So if you give up 5 minutes, but you're still allowed to have the amount of ammunition you want, the amount of rounds you want, then, you know, where do you draw the line? I think that that's not a bad line to draw it at.
Speaking of drawing the line, I have to say, Michael, on this one, it appears that that virtually every one of the three central pieces of legislation, assault weapons has no chance. Even Harry Reid, the Democratic leader in the Senate, doesn't support it. A ban on high-capacity magazines apparently going nowhere. But on this universal background check thing, even though that CBS poll last week showed that there's a 10-point diminution in public support for strict gun control across the board, as Marjorie said, there's still support for universal background checks. It seems to me the Democrats go to the mat on this, even if they end up losing, to say this is the difference between us and them.
They do. And I do think that Harry Reid has moved in favor of that, and that is a huge move. Yeah, sadly, he hasn't moved on the other two big pieces, which I think are as important or more important. But the fear always seems to be with these gun people, these national gun people, is giving anything is a slippery slope. You cannot, you know, safety locks, can't do it. You know, number of bullets in a clip, can't do it. You know, everything is a can't do it. And I do think that Jennifer said it perfectly. You move on that piece and you hold on the other stuff that you think is more important, and that's what politics is. And I think in the end, with Reid moving on that piece is a huge – because he's been a 100% NRA guy.
Can we step back from this? You know what? It seems to me that it is a rare moment in American politics where, as Marjorie said, you have a huge majority that support this thing. And it almost never happens. Isn't it incredibly depressing? Forget that you're a Republican, that you're a Democrat. Isn't it incredibly depressing that this Congress doesn't have the ability even to agree on something where the vast majority of their constituents are with them, Jennifer?
Absolutely. I think there was an article in the Globe last week about Bob Dole, and it really kind of was very emotional. It's a great, great, great piece. And if you haven't read it, you should definitely read it.
This is about the International Treaty on Disabilities that went down the tubes under Broken City is the name of the series. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
It is an amazing story on where Congress is today. And it really is upsetting to see that someone like Bob Dole, who at 89 years old, can't get through Congress because everyone has to dig their heels into the ground and say, no, it's my way or the highway. And so I think that this is a great example of saying we all kind of have to work together. It has to be a communal opportunity. And oh, yeah, by the way, all of your rear ends were sent there by us. We can take you out as quick as we put you in there. And if you're not doing the people's work, then you should not be in office.
Do you know Susan Molinari? Did you know her?
Yes.
Yes. Susan Molinari is a New York congresswoman,
yes.
Republican.
Remember
her. A congressman. He's a wonderful person. She wrote a book. I knew her because I worked for Tip O'Neill at one time. And I always liked her. I thought she was really smart. And she has this book, which I got a copy of it. And in there, there's an amazing scene. Is she had a baby. She brought the baby to the floor of the House. And this was just at the beginning of this period that Jen is describing, you guys are describing. And the people, she was passing the baby around and she turned it back and one of the people put the baby down. And the baby started to crawl to the line that divided the Democrats and Republicans that she didn't cross. And she panicked at the idea that her baby would go in there. I mean, and it's a sad story. It's like the Dole story.
Oh,
how
far
have we
come?
What, you think the Republicans were going to eat the kid?
No. She's a Democrat.
What, you think the Democrats were going to eat the kid?
No, what she thought was, in her mind, she realized how many of her colleagues had started that process, which we've ended up with today, of there's no room, and you know, again, and I don't want to tell old war stories, but Tip O'Neill's best friend was the Republican minority leader, Michaels. And they would go at Bob Michaels, and he would go out every single – they'd meet in the morning for breakfast. They'd go out for dinner at night. At 5 o'clock, the wars ended. It all started to come apart, quite frankly, when Gingrich took over. And it's gotten much worse since then, to the point where we are now, where we can't have any common
ground. Lead of that great story that Jennifer was talking about the International Treaty on Disabilities, was talking about how George Mitchell, the Democratic leader of the Senate, and Bob Dole, the Republican leader, agreed they would never publicly say a bad word about
each other. Right.
Much less. In any case, well, guns, there doesn't seem to be agreement. Apparently on immigration, which is pretty amazing, there is some. Here's Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer from New York. He talked to Chuck Todd on Meet the Press Sunday. Just listen to what Todd has to say, and then you'll hear Schumer.
You were quoted as basically saying the deal is near, the deal is at hand, and all of that coverage got Senator Rubio, Marco Rubio, Florida Republican, who's part of this gang of eight, to say, hey, whoa, 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 no deal yet, that we're closer. So is there a disagreement between the two of you
on how close we are
to a deal?
It's semantics. Business and labor have an agreement and on the future flow, which has been the issue that has undone immigration reform in the past. So this is a major, major obstacle that's overcome. That language hasn't been fully drafted. There'll be little kerfuffles. But I don't think any of us expect there to be problems.
Okay, little kerfuffles, no big problems, says Chuck Schumer. So, Jennifer, one of the theories after the election between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama that was Republicans needed to get more with the program in terms of immigration reform. But good for immigration reform if this does pass. It takes away an advantage that the Democrats have over Republicans, doesn't it?
Oh, well. Am I supposed to say anything else? Oh,
well. Well, Michael, that is an issue, right?
It's a huge issue. And I don't understand, quite frankly, what this is about. I mean, you know, when you have Ron Paul, you know, stop talking about his Texas 25-foot electrified fence in Texas that was going to cost $1 trillion, saying, you know what, we got to figure out a plan. I mean, when he gets it, then you start to think that this is going to happen. And for the Republicans, it makes sense. Your biggest potential growth population are conservative Hispanics who are pro-life and anti-gay rights. As part of that coalition, they could be a huge force. To have cut them out has never made any sense to me. I never have understood it. But I think that right now, after this race, they realize they never are going to win unless they can figure out how to bring those people back.
But if you compare this to the gun discussion we were having a minute ago, obviously a calculation has been made by many Republicans and some conservative Democrats, we shouldn't leave them out, that they can survive a vote on guns where they go against the popular will, but can't survive a vote on immigration where they go against the popular will. I would have assumed it would be the exact opposite.
It's not that. What's happened is about 2.5 years ago, the first polling started to go to make the flip on immigration. People want some kind of plan in play. They don't want it to be free, and they want it to be some work element to it, and to pay a price, maybe a fine of some sort. But no one's talking anymore about trying to remove 12 million people who are inside the country.
Right. And I think that that's an awesome point, which is that, you know, you look at the Republicans' platform, which was horrific. We're going to take these people, we're going to round them up, we're going to send them back home, and if they had kids here, oh well, their kid gets to decide if they want to stay here or go back. I mean, wow, who sapped all of the blood out of our veins? We're not like that. I mean, my grandmother came off the boat from Sicily. They came here for a better life. That's phenomenal. That is the American dream. However, it's now, what do we do? They're here. Obviously, it's not going to happen that we're going to round people up. So we've got to make it, you know, them taxpayers. And how do we do that?
You know, there was a great piece yesterday in The Globe by Farrah Stockman, the argument that a lot of immigrants workers are doing jobs Americans won't do. She had this very frightening article about the, what do they call the H-1B visas, where a lot of companies are giving these visas to immigrants from other countries because they're cheaper than Americans. And these are high-tech jobs. So that was kind of a scary thought, that a lot of Americans who are making $100,000 going to be laid off, and they're going to hire people from other countries that are cheaper for like $75,000. What do you say about that, Jim?
What I say is I'm worried that Jennifer Nasur is going to be expelled from the Republican Party. And here's the issue. It was guns, and then it was immigration. We'll find out where you are in this one. Here's Cardinal Dolan in New York City, back from the conclave, talking about an issue that you don't hear many cardinals talking about.
We got to do better to see that our defense of marriage is not reduced to an attack on gay people. And I admit we haven't been too good at that. We try our darndest to make sure we're not an anti anybody. We're in the defense of what God has taught us about.
If I were in the conclave, I would have voted for Cardinal Dolan. I want to make that clear. But I was not invited to be one of the 117 or whatever cardinals. Every Tuesday, Charlie Baker's with us at 1 o'clock. And every Tuesday, I ask him the same question. He reminds me I've asked him every Tuesday. So I'll ask you instead, as another Republican. Considering the trending on this issue, on gay marriage and rights of gays and lesbians, which is astronomical. Young voters, talk about demographics, 18 to 29%. It's just, what is it, 81% of them support gay marriage. Can a Republican be elected president in 2016, 3.5 long years from now, if they don't support gay marriage?
I think I'm not really sure that that is going to be a possibility. I think that they're going to have to at least be in favor of civil unions if they can't bring themselves to say marriage.
When you say not a possibility, you mean they may not be able to be elected, is
right,
what you're saying.
Right. I think Cardinal Dolan is a perfect example. He was someone who was thought of as going to be the next pope along, you know, with our own cardinal. And so I think that if you start seeing the Catholic Church take a position of we can't be anti-people, so maybe they don't like the word marriage. That's understandable. That is a religious sacrament.
Sure.
However, you know, I think they have to progress on the unions and on rights.
Well, it's been very clear to me for a while. The extraordinary speed of this has been interesting, particularly compared to women who started in 1847 at Seneca Falls. It wasn't until 1920
right.
they got it, or if you figure the 1865, the end of the war, to 1965 before the Civil Rights Bill. This has been an extraordinary 1969, you know, Stonewall. But what somebody said to me, which absolutely floored me, because it was so brilliant, they said, you know, the truth was, if you were a racist, your kid never came home, looked you in the eye and said, I got some news for you, Mom and Dad, I'm black, you know? And what happened is that all of these people who were anti-gay found out their nieces and nephews and aunts and uncles and people they knew that and they worked with, it suddenly overwhelmed them. I, 10 more seconds, when I went to my 20th class reunion, if you put me on a lie detector, the class of 1967, I didn't know a single kid in high school who was gay. I went to my 20th class reunion and said, God, where did all these gay people come from? We just didn't – I mean, the ignorance was stunning. And I think that's really what's really happened. And it's happened so fast because it's everyone's feeling. Name someone who you don't know that doesn't have a relative, friend, or coworker who's
Ralph
gay.
Ralph Portman is a perfect example.
Great
example.
Senator
I mean,
from
he
Ohio.
He is an amazing man. And he came out and said, I support gay marriage. My son is gay. Hey, listen, if that's how you have to learn, that's how you have to learn. And it doesn't matter how you learn. It's that you get there.
I have a theory. That because, depending on which survey you look at, between one-third and one-quarter of American women have had abortions. If every woman who had an abortion came out of the closet and they turned out to be your mother or your spouse or your sister or your dear Aunt Mabel, that would change the argument, too, about Roe v. Wade, if you ask me.
Okay, this is the end of the bipartisan love fest. I can't take this anymore. Goldman and Nasur. Michael, trial starts today with the former head of the probation department. Mr. O'Brien, deeply immersed in Democratic politics, why don't you list for us the three, in order, the three or four Democrats who are most sweating bullets as this trial. That's number one. And number two, this is bad. The more this comes out, the more bad news this is for the Democratic Party. Is it not? Seriously.
No, bad news. Bad
no, go down the list. I mean, seriously.
No, actually, I've never heard of it. What is this case?
No, exactly. My point.
Who, what's his name?
So you have a state rep from Western Massachusetts who's called the king of patronage, Petrocelli. Bob DeLeo, who I am a huge fan of, I should say, the Speaker of the House, but his godson was the youngest probation officer ever. You've got the Senate president, Terry Murray. You have Tim Cahill, who hired the wife of John O'Brien. I mean,
Tim Cahill's taking the fifth.
Exactly.
Don't forget, he's not going to.
That was brutal this morning.
Yeah.
The reason that he was going to take the fifth.
But also, I mean, this is really. I mean, this is going to spill out day after day after day. Bad news, no?
I've always thought that this was the ticking time bomb for a lot of people because the process, you know, Margie comes to me and says, my daughter's graduated from college, you know, she's really smart. She finished at the top of class. You know, can you get her a job at the State House? I'm going to say, yeah, not because she's, because we're friends. That's why in the process by which reps kids got hired or their relatives got hired, ultimately in the end, the question is did they do the job and were they retained because they were bad? In this case, you have a pay to play allegation. That's a totally different thing. And that's what scares a lot of the Democrats. Most Democrats did it because that's what you do. That's what your constituents send you there for, to give you access and to give you an opportunity that you wouldn't have otherwise. Now, the Globe, I've had this discussion with the Globe for a long time. They say this isn't the way it should be. Well, you know, this is the way politics has been forever. If you know somebody, you get in the door. Then you have to stay. This may be different, Jim, and very dangerous, because if they can prove that people they knew were not competent, were not only hired, but were retained because of power.
I think they've already proved it. I think the stories you've read in the paper and the Globe did that spotlight series. Right. I mean, some guy was like 82 becoming the chief probation officer. Somebody else was talking to criminals on their off hours, and she was a probation officer. I think they may have proved it.
But did the Republican – I mean, I'm trying to say, who was the Republican who –
There aren't enough of them, Jim.
I'm saying, who is the Republican who's going to stand up on day 3 of the trial or day 30 of the trial, today's jury selection, and excoriate the Democrats? Who is that Republican? I mean, Charlie Baker, who's with us tomorrow, hasn't announced he's running. Scott Brown is now doing Fox News, and he's doing a law. I'm serious.
Dan Winslow.
Who is the person who's going
to
do this?
I'm happy to do it. I mean, look, this was my motto and my mantra the entire time that I was chairman, is there's one party rule up on Beacon Hill. Anytime there's one party in control, this is what you're going to see. You don't have a normal checks and balance system, which is what American government was founded on. So even though you might not be a Republican, what you have to be honest about is it's better to have more of them there to have an oversight and to make sure that shenanigans
so
like
isn't
this don't
she exactly totally right? Where she's wrong is for 16 years we had Republican governors who
this
stuck.
Didn't happen under a Republican governor.
Let me just say something to you. For 16 years, Republican governors stuffed the payroll with Republican patronage. You cannot go through any department.
They were not liars. They were not incompetent. They were not.
Really? You really want to make the case that
how many trials have we had just in the past 6 years here in Massachusetts? How many Democrats have been up through the federal court system? We don't see
and
that.
The probation
with the
department is almost all Democrats. It's almost
absolutely
all Democrats,
yes, that
and
was
that's
Democratic
such
pension.
An important position, because you were supervising people who are felons or very serious.
But don't think how many. Let me ask you: how many Democrats did Bill Weld, Cellucci, Swift, or Romney put in? Name the head of a department that was a name an assistant secretary. Name a secretary that
wasn't
connected.
Failure to appoint a Democrat is not the same
as having
a pay-to-play system for a probation department.
I agree with that.
So what's the comparison?
But what she's trying to say, and this
No, what I'm saying is that you need more Republicans to watch over to make sure that the scandals are not going on.
To put more Republicans in?
Elect more Republicans.
Michael, if there was not one party rule on Beacon Hill in the legislature, you think this would have happened?
No,
yes,
not
if absolutely.
No,
if you
don't want
to be corrupt, you can be corrupt. I know of enormous numbers of times where Democrats and Republicans have been in party where they put in people and there wasn't corruption.
Send us a list.
Michael,
it's 3-1 here, Michael. You lose. That's my declaration. Okay, Jennifer Nasur, thank you for being with us, former chair of the Massachusetts Republican Party, and Michael Goldman, president of Goldman Associates.
Can I throw in one plug?
Thank you both for being here.
Yeah, sure.
One
quick
plug. David Bernstein, for those of you, anyone who's listening to the show and cares about substance, David Bernstein at the Phoenix. Phoenix is no longer there. He now has a blog called blog.davidsbernstein.com. He did a terrific thing today. He put out
The brackets.
The brackets. Yeah. No one else would have thought about something like that.
For presidential race.
No. For the mayor.
Mayor's race, I'm sorry.
64 bodies to stick in the brackets. And he is such a clever guy. It would be terrible if his voice politically, was lost.
I didn't know there were 64 members of the city council. But that's incredible.
I also didn't see any Republicans on that list.
wisely.
Thank you both. See
coming
you again soon.
Stop the Madness. March Madness generates millions of dollars for schools and the NCAA. Everybody gets lots of money except for the players. Time to start paying them, too. We'll debate that up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Just to get you, you're listening to Boston Public Radio, by the way, with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Just to get you in the mood, if you missed it, here's the end of the Syracuse-Marquette game that got Syracuse into the Final Four.
Trish, Nice. Oh, what a spin move. Almost lost his dribble.
Wow. Oh. Pretty. Wow. Look at his smile. They can feel it right now. The march to Atlanta by the Cuse.
Okay, so it's Michigan, Louisville, Wichita State, and Syracuse, all Final Four. The schools are going to make a bundle. The coaches are often some of the highest paid people on campus. But the players don't share. Should they? Should they be paid, or is a scholarship enough? Joining us on the phone is David Burry. He's a sports economist, professor of economics at Southern Utah University. His new piece on the Freakonomics blog is How About a Free Market for College Athletes? David, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dave, the more I read about this, the more incensed I get. Jim just mentioned the coaches with these million-dollar-plus salaries. Some of them are rivaling what the NBA guys get. All this money that the NCAA gets from the networks buying the rights to broadcast these programs, the players seem like indentured servants. They don't even get a cut when they've got the player's picture on some T-shirt. So we should pay these guys, should we not?
That's in every other market in the economy, that's what we do. Everyone who doesn't want to pay the players participates in a labor market where somebody pays them. And they've set up a rule saying, well, we can't pay these employees. These employees we're going to label amateurs, and they don't get paid. And in every other labor market, if somebody came to you and said, I'm not going to pay you because I've decided that your label is amateur, so you don't get paid, you would probably sue them and say, well, you're not allowed to do that. But we've done this in college sports now for about 100 years. And it just continues on because the players don't have the ability or the incentive to organize or protest because they're only going to be there for 4 years or so, and then they move on.
Or less. Our number is 877-301-8970. If you want to weigh in on whether or not these athletes, these extraordinary athletes you watch playing over the weekend, you're going to watch next weekend, whether they should share in the huge amount of money their schools are getting from CBS and their coaches are making. My understanding, David, is there's a little bit of movement in terms of the leader, the new president, relatively new president of the NCAA, that they're talking about at least some stipend, I guess based on the notion that if you're a non-athlete on a college, you go to class and you can get a part-time job. If you're an athlete, you can't even get a part-time job because you theoretically have to go to class and you got to practice. So you're really behind the eight ball.
Yeah, there is a movement to give them something. So they have admitted that they'd like to pay them something. It's a very small payment. It's $300 or something like that. Nowhere near the amount of money that these players are generating for their schools. So it is the case that on every other job we have on campus, we do pay people. I've made the point recently that I have someone who grades my exams for me, and she gets paid. She doesn't do it because she loves grading. I did tell her, though, after last few weeks, I have said I'd like to relabel her an amateur grader and not pay her anymore. And she said that, no, she's a professional, and she's probably better at it than I am.
So she probably can't dunk, though, so that's why she doesn't get it. David, why don't you talk about you do an analysis of some of these players and how much they contribute to wins and how much a win generates for a college. But I don't want to talk about just the superstars. It seems to me that if you go to a college that's one of the major Division I schools, and they're making a ton of dough here, and you're not one of that infinitesimally small number of people who make it to the NBA, there's a decent shot you may not even graduate. You really get nothing out of this thing, and the school gets to use you for 4 years and then
disgusting.
Throw you away.
It's disgusting to me.
So even if it's a bench player, why shouldn't everybody that plays for a big college team in a big money-making sport like football and basketball, why shouldn't everybody get essentially some sort of salary?
Yeah, that's the argument I've made. And I've gone through and I've measured. You can go through it with respect to basketball players. You can measure how many wins they produce. We can look at what the wins are worth in terms of revenue. So we can estimate what they'd be worth. But I would, rather than go through and estimate a player's value and compensate them in that fashion, I would rather have just make it open that the schools can compensate the players as they wish and make it a free market. And let the schools decide what they would have to do to get a player on their campus. And I would suspect for most players, it would probably still be a scholarship. Most student athletes, scholarship would be enough to get them on campus. But there'd be some that wouldn't be enough, And schools should be allowed to pay them whatever the market is for those players.
Our numbers are 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970, if you want to weigh in on whether college athletes, especially in this in these the NCAA March Madness, should be paid. You can also email us at wgbh.org. Excuse me, bpr@wgbh.org. Dave, the more I read about this, the more incensed I get. You read stories about how between 2003 and 2011, coaches' salaries have gone up 131% in some of these colleges. It's crazy. And at the same time, you have some of these kids who can't even afford to have their families come out and see them play because a lot of them come from very impoverished neighborhoods and they can't afford it. There's something really just creepy about it, especially as the amount of money the colleges make off these kids has gone through the roof.
Yeah, one of the arguments that the schools make when this gets brought to their attention is they'll come out and they'll say something to the effect that we're not even making a profit off these guys. And the reason why that is because this money that they earn gets spent. And where it gets spent primarily is on the coach's salary. So often it is the case, if you go through the public records in a state and look at who the highest paid public employee is in the state, it is often the coach of a basketball team or a football team in that state. They make more than the governor, they make more than the university presidents. And when you compare those salaries of those people to what professionals make, John Calipari's salary at Kentucky rivals what an NBA coach makes. And the reason why that's odd is because an NBA team makes about five times the revenue of Kentucky basketball. And so the only way Kentucky can pay Calipari that kind of a salary is because they're not actually paying the workers that Calipari's employing. And so that money gets spent on his salary. And that's why he likes coaching college basketball and not coaching the NBA. He gets a very good salary. He gets like $4 million a year. He gets to win a lot because he recruits a lot of guys who are going to go on to the NBA. And so this is a really good deal for him.
You know, we're talking to Dave Berry from Southern Utah University, who's written a great piece about, I guess, not his word, ours, the injustice. Derek Jackson is a columnist for the Boston Globe, who every year for almost the last two decades has done a thing about black graduation rates from the teams that make it into the NCAA tournament. Let me just pick one here. Syracuse is one of the Final Four. 43% of their black players graduate. That means 57% don't. 80% of their white players, which means 20% don't. So that 20% of white, 57% of black, are making a major contribution, obviously, to the university's budget, their bottom line. They're not going to leave with a degree, so their employability is obviously limited. So if you had the president of the NCAA standing here or the president of Syracuse University standing here, Dave, what would their response be when you say, pay these people, they're providing a real service?
Yeah, it's not in their interest to do that. I mean, these people benefit financially from this situation. And so that they would, I once actually, when Miles Brand was the president of the NCAA, I had a chance to speak to him briefly.
What did
he
say?
I brought this up to him. And he made the argument that if we paid the players, well, then college basketball would just become a minor league basketball league. And wouldn't that be awful? And I'm like, why would that be awful? That's
well, it's also, it hasn't hurt the Olympics, has it? I mean, the reality is every one of these athletes is being paid. In any case, Dave, your piece is a spectacular piece. Everybody should check it out. It's on Freakonomics. And Dave Berry's from Southern Utah University. Thanks so much for your time, Dave. We appreciate it.
Certainly.
Dave, thank you very much. 877-301-8970 are our numbers. Like I said,
I'm like you. I'm in the sense, too.
And also, when you read that a lot of these players are featured in video games, and they don't even get a cut of the video
games. That's what one of the lawsuits
like
is about.
If Jim Browdy was out there running around a basketball court, which wouldn't happen, but if it did, and Jim Browdy doesn't get 5 cents off the video that's exploited his name, it's just incredible.
Also, how about the kid for Louisville who had that horrible leg broken yesterday? I mean, talk about the sacrifice that kid made, maybe potentially career-ending,
right,
for
so
his school. Is he getting compensated?
It's almost like medieval England with, like I said, the indentured servants working the land, and the king comes and takes all your taxes.
It's like Game of Thrones, Marjorie.
That's
what you're trying to say.
I've missed Game of Thrones, Jim.
You're lucky. Let's go to Ann in Medford. Ann in Medford, you are first on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hey, Ann.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
This is a very interesting concept. I guess I never thought that you would pay college athletes on top of already giving them an education. I just feel like when we get obsessed about college sports, including I know basketball and football are the biggies. Just that we lose sight of the fact that people are there for an education. And, you know, you talk about the graduation rates in these teams. I think it's a shame that oftentimes the sports gets emphasized over the education aspect.
But you know,
maybe that's
a...
naive, but maybe they need a new venue, you know, something in between college and the NBA, but that's just how I feel.
Well, I think the answer, Ann, is, and this is part of the piece in Derek Jackson's piece, he speaks to Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, and tries to get him to the point. If it turns out you can't graduate X percent of your athletes after over a series of years, then why should you even be allowed to play in these high-profile, multi-million-dollar generating tournaments? I think that's the solution, and then the graduation rate would go up, Ann. Thanks.
Well, you also read what these kids' days are like. I mean, they get up in the morning, they go lift weights, they go to the gym, they go to a class, they go back to the gym, they practice all afternoon, then they have to study a little bit, and it's time for bed. I mean, they are basically working full-time jobs. I think they should be compensated for it, especially when so many people are making millions off their backs. Wayne from Acton. You are on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling, Wayne.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie.
Hey, Wayne.
Let me say, great to hear you two back on the air.
Thank you.
I tend to agree with Ann. I think, you know, the players are getting visibility. They're getting national coverage. They're getting to hone their skills to prepare them for the NBA. And unless you believe that a college education, for which my grandson is going to spend $200,000 to get an undergraduate degree, I think that they are being compensated, and like Ann said, the real shame is how the players are treated in terms of, you know, the ones that aren't going to make it to the NBA, who leave college with no degree, with really very limited in the way of skills for them to earn a living as ordinary citizens. And I don't know, I think we put too much emphasis on sports to start paying kids to go to college, to be on teams. Is the wrong way to go.
But Wayne, I was just going to say about a lot of the kids that play basketball, especially if they come from tough cities and they don't have very good schools in a lot of these cities. I mean, you go to New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, the public schools are a mess. If a kid comes from a public school but he happens to be a great athlete, it seems to me the school, which is going to make millions of dollars off this kid's athletic skills, has some sort of obligation to make sure if he does come in a little bit behind because he came from bad schools, that they help him get that education. And I don't see that happening either. They're just getting rich off him.
And that's my point. That's my point. The schools, you know, need to make sure that these kids are taking courses that are worthwhile, that are going to help them be gainfully employed if they're not Michael Jordan and not getting into the NBA. And that, I think, is the bigger crime. A lot of the kids coming out of these programs who just can't quite make it at that level have very little to show for it.
Well, how about this, Wayne? How about the compromise being what I said a minute ago? If you can't graduate, pick a number, 75% of your players over a 4 or 5 year period, then you just can't go to March Madness. And all of a sudden, these colleges will start valuing education. Wayne, thanks for the call and the kind words.
You know what I'd like to see? You get, if you're expected to be playing basketball 50 hours a week or playing football 50 hours a week, then you get an extra year or two after your playing time is over to work on your education, and they guarantee they're going to help you get that education. Because that's, like you said before, when you don't go to the NBA, most of these kids are not.
99% of them don't
exactly
go to the NBA.
99%. Okay, 99%. Amy from Boston, thanks for calling WGBH 89.7. What do you think, Amy?
I agree with your last two callers 100%. These kids are getting, I mean, these kids, like, they're playing for Duke, for goodness sakes. They're getting a scholarship to some of the most premier universities in our country. And I don't think above and beyond that they need to be paid. What they do need is when they step foot, like you mentioned, some of the kids coming from the inner city public schools, when they step foot in the university, they need to be set up with a tutor that is going, and that school guarantees that they will graduate. And no matter what they have to do, whether, like you said, it's a 5-year program, 6-year program, they're going to leave with, for what they do for the team, you know, with the sport, they're guaranteed a diploma.
Well, Duke has
how long it takes.
Duke has 100% graduation rate.
That's fair.
And, blacks and
George,
whites.
And Georgetown does. There are some of these schools, Amy, that are really making an effort. I know Georgetown does. You just mentioned Duke. I think Stanford has a pretty good graduation rate, too. But a lot of the other big schools are in the NCAA tournaments every year.
You know what else I think some people forget also is these kids come in, like you said, some, you know, their parents can't even come and watch them or whatever. And they come from a background where they have, like, you know, they have no money. And they come in with some of, you know, a lot of these kids that have come from private schools are very well off, And how are they going to live, you know, with these other kids? I mean, is anybody going to give these kids spending money? I mean, what about going and getting a pizza on Friday night?
Well, that's what some people are talking about, a $2,000 a year stipend.
That's ahead of the NCAA is contemplating that as sort of a compromise thing because they don't have the time to go get a part-time job like every other kid on the campus does.
And so they need an education and they also have to be guaranteed a quality of life while they're there.
Yeah, I think so too. Amen. If you can't afford to get a pizza and you're making $2 million for the school every year, it just seems awful. Anyway, we have been talking with David Berry before this. He was a sports economist, professor of economics at Southern Utah University, who also thinks that these athletes should be paid. You can find a link to his piece at WGBHnews.org.
Can I, before we leave this, you know, the other thing, every caller either who got through or who's on the line,
disagree
the lines
with
are
us.
Full. However, does it not offend you that a man in these cases, I think they're all men, well, they are all men in this case, are making anywhere from $500, $600, $1 million, $2 million to coach these young men who are making not a nickel
That's
other than
I'm
their
saying.
Scholarship?
I think it's like indentured service. I've said it three times now. It's sort of disgusting that they're, I think, exploiting these young athletes who are not going to make it to the NBA, and these kids don't – I mean, how can you sell somebody's T-shirt with their name on it and not even give them a dime? I mean, it's just outrageous. But anyway, no one agreed with Jim, so I guess we weren't very persuasive. up next, lots of us, this is sort of a new trend. We are critiquing our doctors, a lot of it negative, on sites like Yelp and Angie's List. Did you hear, though? One local doctor just sued. I'm going to give you full details next on 89.7 WGBH.
What do you get when your primary care physician teams up with a social worker, pharmacist, and nutritionist? It's a growing trend called a medical home.
By having various professionals who are coordinating, who are accessible 24/7, we think that that's getting closer to what patients actually want.
And it might be a cheaper and more effective model for healthcare. I'm Liz Alessi, the story of a medical home in Jamaica Plain, this afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Butler Hospital, conducting a research study for depression requiring daily visits for 6 weeks involving a new form of brain stimulation. Information at 401-455-6537 or newdepressionstudy.com. And Brown University's pre-college summer programs, where high school students can prepare for college success, experience college life, and make new friends from around the world. More than 200 courses now open. brown.edu/summer.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And you know, yesterday, the Globe featured a very touching story about a man whose wife died after having surgery. The guy sought a meeting with a doctor who performed the operation. It was denied. So he goes online, writes an open letter criticizing the doctor's care, and the result, he's sued. And raising the larger issue of posting reviews of doctors online, on one hand, the First Amendment right of the patient. On the other hand, is a debate where the doctor has his or her hands tied behind their back because of patient doctor-patient confidentiality. Here to try to sort out these issues with us is Dr. Michael Grodin. He's professor of health law, bioethics, and human rights at Boston University School of Public Health. Dr. Grodin, it's great to talk to you.
Thank you.
So what do you think about this, Dr. Grodin? More and more people apparently are complaining about their physicians online.
Well, it's a reflection of a problem that's been going on for a long time, which is the issue of communication. I do bioethics, and I am involved in consultation and dealing with conflicts all the time in the hospital. And 99% of the time, the issue is really a communication problem. The issue is good ethics start with good facts. And the bottom line is that patients need to do a better job of coming forward and asking questions and trying to understand the nature and consequences of the various treatment modalities that are offered. And physicians certainly need to do a much better job of explaining what the issues are. But there are a couple points that I would make.
Sure,
one is, that one needs to go over what the goals of treatment are much more carefully, and what's achievable, and whether the possibility of achieving those goals is something within the realm of possibility. One needs to really deal with the difference between a bad outcome and negligence. And just because there's a bad outcome doesn't mean that there's negligence or malpractice. Apologies are fine, and I think that people need to do a better job of apologizing when bad outcomes occur, but that doesn't mean that there was a cause of neglect. So I think that difficult cases are difficult because they're difficult, and I think we need to do a much better job of communicating what the expectations are, what the goals of treatment are, and what the trials of therapy will lead to.
We're talking to Dr. Michael Grodin from BU, but you know, one of the ironies here is if the husband was on the phone with us, I assume he would say, I was trying to communicate with this doctor both during the treatment, maybe I didn't ask all the right questions, and I surely was trying to communicate with this doctor. In fact, I sought a meeting after my wife died. But when the doctor then says, I'm sorry, I'm not going to sit down and talk, whatever the reason is,
The lawyer from the Brigham told the doctor not to talk to the patient's husband.
That was obviously bad advice by the lawyer and bad advice by the physician. Obviously, what one needs to do is to communicate and even apologize for bad outcomes, which are sometimes unavoidable, but again, don't mean necessarily negligence.
Dr. Grodin, if I can, let's assume everything is done either, well, it doesn't matter, perfectly, imperfectly. At the end of the process, the patient, sort of like a customer at a restaurant or someone who stayed at a hotel, says, frankly, I'm not satisfied with the service, and short of libel or I'm going to tell my story. My initial position when I'm thinking about this and reading the story this morning is, of course, go for it. Why shouldn't you be able to do it? But then what hadn't occurred to me, I'm almost embarrassed to admit, is the doctor can't participate in this discussion because he or she is bound by patient doctor confidentiality. So it's sort of like only one person gets to play.
Right. Well, and the other problem, of course, is that difficult cases are often done by physicians. Physicians take on difficult cases because they are expert. And, of course, judging what's the difference between going to the Mass General, where you may take the most difficult problematic neurosurgical cases, and a community hospital means that there can be different outcomes, which are going to be hard to judge based on different locations of care.
But regardless,
the bottom line is that there needs to be better communication.
Okay, we all agree.
Physicians certainly need to respond to questions the patients have, follow up. Obviously, there appears, at least from the article, that there was inadequate communication by the physician and the lawyer. If the lawyer recommended not to speak to the patient, that was a big mistake.
But let's assume the lawyer didn't recommend that, Dr. Grodin, and even after having met with the physician, the husband, who still feels aggrieved, and according to his shrink, apparently is part of the grieving process, says, I want to write something for the public to know about this particular doctor. What's your take on that? Should the patient not be able to express themselves? And then what does the doctor do, again, because they're bound because of confidentiality? What do both sides do?
Well, obviously, the physician needs to communicate, talk to the patient, try to understand what their concerns are, what their worries, what their fears, what was the problem of what was told and what was expected. And the patient needs to follow through and follow up on what their concerns are.
And what happens if the patient is still not satisfied at the end of that process?
Well,
should the patient then be able to publicly say online, I'm dissatisfied with the services of Dr. X?
Yeah, of course they're able to do that. I think the problem is how one interprets that and what the goal of that posting is. What the goal is to improve care, to get some type of closure from their own perspective. So it draws attention, obviously, to the negative review by bringing a lawsuit. So I think that's problematic from all perspectives. So the idea is we want to keep this out of a legal context. But obviously, the idea is what the goal of the posting is.
Well, this particular surgeon, part of the reason I'm sure she sued is because as soon as you Googled her name, the first thing that came up was this complaint from the dead woman's husband that the woman had been inadequately treated. We're talking with Dr. Michael Grodin, who's a professor at Boston University School of Public Health. You know, there is this new law, Dr. Grodin, that protects a Massachusetts law that protects doctors' apologies. What's the genesis of that?
Well, what we realized again is that communication leads to a lot of better improvement in care and improvement in understanding what the actual nature of the problem was. And so physicians, it turns out that by ringing in ranks and not talking to the patient, one actually causes more problems and more lawsuits in the end than if one honestly and appropriately goes to the patient and says that there's been a problem, there's been a bad outcome. And again, we could all agree that there's been a bad outcome, that we can apologize for that. Again, it's a different discussion as to what the cause was and whether there was a negligence. But oftentimes physicians conflated and patients conflate bad outcome with negligent care, and those things need to be separated out.
Our number is 877-301-8970. If you went away, and have you ever posted about your doctor and his or her performance in your case or someone else's? Do you read those posts? Do they affect your decision? And do you think it's fair? I want to get back to my original thought, though, here, Dr. Grodin, is it seems the doctor is put at a real disadvantage, even if he or she has done everything right, because of the privilege. And so let me make a suggestion and tell me how ridiculous this is.
Yeah.
That if a patient chooses to go public with criticism, even if it's 100% legit, obviously you don't know, if it chooses to go public with criticism of a doctor, that doctor then be freed from whatever confidentiality obligation he or she has to the patient. Why wouldn't that be an equitable?
I don't think you can breach confidentiality based on that. Obviously, the only time where confidentiality is breached is in a malpractice case where you obviously have to defend yourself. But I don't think you should breach confidentiality. But I do think that the other side of the coin is that if people are using recommendations that are put online on blogs and what have you as a reason to seek care and not seek care of a physician, then that's probably not the best way to go about trying to find out the best information about your physician. And on the other hand, physician communication is so important that I often, as a physician and professor, I often get the question from patients and for medical students saying, which would you rather have, the best surgeon possible or the physician or surgeon who has the best bedside manner, as if they're mutually exclusive. I think that obviously you can have both. You can have the best surgeon and the best communicator, and that's obviously what we look for in our physician.
Well, how do you find out information about your doctors? I mean, most people, I think, just do word of mouth.
Well, the Board of Registration of Medicine, has online at least the number of suits that have been brought in. But it's very hard to interpret that.
Yeah.
Again, suits are brought and suits are not settled, or suits are settled and not brought to trial. And so it's very hard to tell. And again, some fields are everybody's sued. And again, if you're practicing in a very high-risk area and you're taking the most complicated cases, there may be a higher chance of having a lawsuit.
Well, then, so how do you tell? I mean, I think this is why people are on Yelp and Angie's List, of course, because they go there for restaurants. Why not go there for physicians? I think that's one of the big problems for patients or anybody, healthy or not healthy, how you find out whether your doctor is a great doctor. It's hard.
Yeah, no, I agree. That's why I think that the physicians giving recommendations for other physicians, I think, is a good way. I think that, again, a lot of these ratings of physicians where other physicians are asked who they would go to or who they would recommend, I think is more positive.
Yeah.
Obviously, the issue of licensure, the issue of a board certification, the issue of where they have privileges, these are all things that are monitored and better information can be gleaned from those sources, which I think are much better than a blog.
But Dr. Grodin, I'm going to try one more time at this because I'm now you made the distinction between criticism online on a blog and a malpractice suit. If you go to a malpractice suit, then you're obviously freed from your confidentiality.
You have to be able to defend yourself.
But why aren't you making an arbitrary distinction? We've spoken in our former radio lives, we've spoken to people whose restaurants have been destroyed because someone put an incredibly critical thing on a website or same thing could happen to a doctor. So while it's not technically,
doctors are professionals, and I think professional relationships are different than consumer relationships, and I think we need to treat those differently.
Yeah, but one more piece, though. When Marjorie was asking you, how do you make a judgment, and you gave some answers, the problem I've always had with this is when people equate the whole transparency argument about information out there, regardless of where it is, it's difficult enough for most of us to be able to decide what phone company we want to use. The notion that when you were involved, and for most of it, it's not that emotional. When you're choosing what doctor is going to take care of you or somebody you love,
right,
it's an incredibly emotion-laden kind of thing, which makes it even more difficult. It puts the patient in an even more difficult position, no?
I agree. I think that that's a very good point. And that's why I think that you want to have the best primary care doctor who knows you and cares for you over time to help you make those consultations.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the tragedy is that there's less and less primary care doctors. It's harder and harder to get appointments.
I don't know.
They have less and less time with you. But I think you want to have a long-term relationship with a primary care doctor who you trust and who can help you with those times, particularly when, again, it's an emergent or life-threatening situation where you're not going to have the time and the ability to negotiate the system.
You know, in anticipation of this discussion, doctor, I checked my primary care physician's, this is true, rating this morning, and I was holding my breath, and she was 5 out of 5 stars.
So really? Where did you get the rating?
I just Googled her and went online.
You Googled her?
Let's go to
Who gave her the rating?
What?
Who gave her the rating?
It was either on Yelp or some medical website.
There you go. It's on
Patients,
Yelp or medical. Yeah. I always feel as though sometimes my primary physician is giving me recommendations to her kind of sad sack friends have had difficulty getting patients. I don't know. I haven't been all that impressed by my referrals.
Let's take a call if we can here. Dominique, you're from Rehoboth. You're on with Dr. Groden. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for making it.
So I'm really pleased to hear you guys are talking about this. I feel really bad for the person, the man that you're talking about, who's in this dilemma. I myself had surgery about a year and a half ago. It wasn't anything major, certainly not life-threatening. But I was really displeased with the outcome. And in fact, I've had other specialists who have told me that I'm going to have more surgery to correct the first one. And the problem that I had was that when I went to the first doctor, they really said that it was such an easy procedure. I was never told about any risk involved whatsoever. It was almost like, oh, you're here for this problem, which I'll fix. There's this other problem that I should easily be able to fix while I'm in there, and you should just do it. It's fine. It'll take 2 minutes, like as if it was nothing, and then that's what has caused me the problem. And that doctor has completely blown me off. Since then, I've tried talking to them and figuring out, what the problem is. And
yeah.
Hold it there. Dominique, let's find out. What does she do? Based on what you know from that brief story, what does Dominique do, Dr. Groden?
Well, what she does is obviously calls the physician and explain that there is dissatisfaction with what kind of care she received and concern about the outcome and what was told to her in terms of her voluntary informed understanding consent. Obviously, before you have any procedure, you need to understand the risks and benefits and alternatives, what will happen with treatment, what will happen without treatment. And that's the best communication of all. So the patient has the understanding of what the options are and what the risks and benefits are of each possibility. So I think that was, if she didn't have that information before she proceeded with the procedure, then voluntary informed understanding consent was not obtained.
Dominique, thanks for your call. Good luck to you.
And Dr. Groden, thanks for joining us. I'm still not sure where I should go to find out about the secret lives of the doctors that maybe I may be involved with. But thank you very much for joining us. Dr. Michael Groden is professor of health law, bioethics, and human rights at Boston University School of Public Health. Do you think you can have great surgeon and great bedside manner both in the same person?
The answer is yeah. I've actually been really lucky. I've had a lot of doctors. And I know what you're going to say, and let's not get into it, because you're going to violate the co-host privilege, which I think you should.
You've had some doctors that were great credentials, but they were not very nice individuals, and Jim didn't care. You know why Jim didn't care?
Why?
Because he's not very nice.
Only kidding.
Coming up, it is Open Mic with the Reverend Eugene Rivers. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Dr. Samson Davis grew up on the tough streets of Newark, New Jersey, but in his new book, he says med school wasn't a ticket out of town, but a way to come back and help out, and he hopes he can inspire others to follow his lead. Living and Dying in Brick City, that's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Newbury Court, a full-service residential community for persons over the age of 62. Newbury Court in Concord, Massachusetts. You can schedule a visit any day of the week by visiting newburycourt.org. And Welch & Forbes, celebrating 175 years of serving as wealth advisors to New England families. Welch & Forbes, knowing wealth, knowing you. On the web at welchforbes.com.
You're You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy. That'd be me and Marjorie Egan. Joining us as he does every Monday on Open Mic, usually about 1 o'clock or a couple of minutes behind, he's the co-founder of the 10-Point Coalition. Welcome, Reverend Eugene Rivers III.
Hello, greetings, good people.
Reverend Rivers.
How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
You people are so smart. I'm just so impressed.
We are?
Well, thank you.
Oh, yeah.
I think you were listening to a different show, but thank you anyway.
Or he had low expectations. Maybe that could be it, Jim. Anyway, so handicap the mayor's race for us. You're in the thick of it. What do you think? What's going to happen?
Well,
who's going to be the next mayor?
It's interesting. Number one, I think that the Menino regime has disbanded. So, and I was talking to a very informed person Friday night, and he was saying, look, the juice and the leverage and the power is not immediately transferable. So one of the things that I think is actually quite fascinating about this race is that, number one, the black political leadership infrastructure had 20 years to develop some candidates. We have nothing. There's not
nothing?
One, nothing. We've got some pretty faces that exist to make sensitive white liberals feel good and say they're people of color, right? Because we always need some people of color for sensitive white liberals to feel good, right? You know, that's essential, right? So you got to, you know, pretty faces, they're very young. None of them.
Who's a pretty face? Ayanna Pressley?
Ayanna Pressley and Tito Jackson.
Both city councilors.
I'm not sexist.
Both
okay,
city councilors,
right?
Okay. They are young.
And you've got Felix Arroyo.
Felix Arroyo.
They're all young people that are inexperienced and have no money. They don't have a dime. So they're in no, I mean, so it's nice to float it out because you've got nothing to write and it's a slow news day, right? So you put the pictures in the paper. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, beyond the symbolism, it doesn't mean anything.
Well, except let's just, for a second, I don't know if you're talking about inexperience or money or both. Take
both.
Dan Conley for a moment out of the equation, who apparently, he's the Suffolk County DA.
Who does
apparently
have
has $850,000 in the bank. You can make the exact same statement about most of the white people who have their pictures in the Globe and the Herald as potential candidates.
Most
relatively
of them.
Inexperienced.
Right.
And the one thing that separates him is he's got a ton of dough, right?
Well, no. Yes, that's true. Now, you've got Marty Walsh, who's not
state
inexperienced.
Rep.
State rep. Not inexperienced. Will have money because he's king of the unions.
Mm-hmm.
So he shall, in short order, have money. Now, the question is, are the South Boston, are the my Irish brothers and sisters smart enough to negotiate a deal with the black community around who the next mayor would be in a context where we don't have a credible candidate? And the most important question for the black community, y'all, is what happens to the 60% of developable land that exists in Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan? That's the game. Right. So you got to follow the money, as my friends say. Right. See, so you have $1.6 billion that goes on in terms of, capital construction. Then you have 60% of developable land that needs to be planned and thought through. If I'm the black community and I have an IQ over 12, I say, let's negotiate a deal with the Irishman. And then in exchange for a black director of the BRA. So I've got some play.
Boston Redevelopment Authority
right.
for
Boston
the uninitiated.
To get the
yeah.
development in Roxbury,
exactly.
Dorchester,
exactly.
and Mattapan.
And produce some millionaires and create jobs, opportunity, and training. That's
yep.
the smart money.
So let's say we're in a majority-minority city in Boston. Let's think it happened 2-3 years ago.
Yes.
So is your position months before the runoff, obviously, and the two top finalists make
sure.
it to the final, is your position that nothing will happen between now and that date that would cause, other than this liaison you're describing, that would cause a person of color to make it into the final two? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that if Ralph Martin,
former Suffolk County DA,
who everyone had high hopes for,
of course,
very
if
smart
Ralph
guy,
Martin,
he's making money as a lawyer now.
There you go.
He's at Bingham Dana Gould.
Ralph Martin's following the money.
Yeah.
So what's the end of the
decided.
Sentence? That unless there's a Ralph Martin, you're essentially saying it's two white finalists.
And Ralph Martin, who was the former Suffolk County
yes,
District Attorney,
correct.
Everybody thought he was going to run then. Of course, Menino was still there.
Yes.
But he's kind of been forgotten by lots of people because he's been out of politics for
Wait, sure.
5 years,
and he retired.
10 years?
Now, listen, the money guys would get behind Ralph and they'd gin it up and there'd
right.
be a press tsunami. And he would get the Obama touch, and there'd be lots of airbrush, and he'd be fine.
Yeah.
You can do that in 3 or 4 months of good, good media, right? But barring a Ralph Martin-type person, the black community doesn't have a bench.
Yeah,
That's
but it seems
rule.
To me, as Gene Rivers, it seems to me that part of the problem is the money. part of the reason may be the bench, and part of the problem is you. And I don't mean just you.
Yeah.
I mean the generic you.
Yes.
If one says, if one has a fairly high-profile voice
yes.
in communities of color, as you do,
sure.
and you basically say, we have no chance to field a candidate who could be a credible player in this field, that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
No, not at all. Not,
money people say, wait a second, I heard Reverend Rivers say,
not at all.
Jane Doe and John Doe have no chance.
No,
I'm not going to throw any money in their direction.
Let me give you two examples that are interesting that contradict that. Nobody thought that a skinny, light-skinned dude from Illinois who had an odd name, Barack H. Obama, right?
Hussein.
Yeah, and in fact, I was Hussein Obama.
Yeah.
And when Samantha Power came to me and said I needed to get on the train, I said, Samantha, what's your problem, child? Barack Obama? I wouldn't vote for what's wrong with her, right? Now, there were all the naysayers.
Samantha Power teaches at Harvard and is a foreign policy advisor to the candidate and then the president.
Yes. So my point is that that's not true because, you know, I wasn't putting my money behind this dude. But when Bubba Clinton, you jumped out of a window with his kind of racially tinged remarks in South Carolina during that
change.
Saying that Jesse Jackson won this primary,
too. Right. Exactly. We shifted. All I'm saying is this. Listen, the black community had 20 years to develop talent. So you had multiple players on the bench so you could have fielded it. We did not. We failed. This is no talking about.
Was Ayanna Pressley not the top vote getter in one of the last
two
city councils?
Yes, she was. And Arroyo was second.
Top vote getter and Arroyo second.
Yes.
Both people of color, which again seems to me to belie the notion that they can't get enough votes to make it into a final.
No. A couple of things. Number one, when you're looking for a mayor, at the end of the day, can the mayor cut the deal?
Who would have thought Tom Menino could cut the deal when he first became the mayor of the city of Boston? I think most people 20 years ago were horrified. They said, oh, my God, Kevin White, Ray Flynn, and now Tom Menino.
Most people thought, if you go back and read those pieces, what Marjorie said is so true. They thought he was going to be interim mayor for 69 days.
Caretaker.
And then Jim Brett or somebody else was going to be the mayor. So that's a great point.
And he couldn't deal with all those highfalutin developers.
All the fancy people. Underestimated.
They did.
The Italian guy.
Yeah, so maybe we're going to underestimate the Latino guy.
No, I'm not
Felix
the fancy
Arroyo.
People. No. I'm in the hood every day, right?
Yeah, but
and
Arroyo,
all I'm saying,
Arroyo's an impressive...
Listen.
How about
I
Mike
say,
Ross? He's not a person of color, but he was a former president.
No. Mike should throw his hat in the ring and take a shot. Oh, I agree. Listen, all I'm saying is that I understand the symbolic, sentimental value of having people of color, right, in the game. I'm trying to be engaged in some real politique. 10 years, the real game for the black community is, what do you do with $1 billion worth of development that happens to be in your hood, right? And who do you have that's strong enough to go eyeball to eyeball with the big guys that come to the poker table, right, and negotiate how the black community moves forward the next 10 years?
And there is no such person, according to Eugene Rivers.
Well, no, I haven't seen him. They may be. Jim Browdy may know him. I just don't.
Okay, fair enough. Let's go to another topic on which we had a slight disagreement last week, namely gay marriage. You were with us on Monday.
Yeah.
Yes. Is it true that you then ended up on the National Mall on Tuesday?
Yes.
And that's where the primary demonstrations from those who
were
not supportive of gay marriage. What was that like?
It was fascinating.
What was the scene? Who was there?
No. It was fascinating. So I pull in around 7 o'clock in the morning, and I go over to the mall. And I'm over there with all the cave people, right? All the ignorant cave people that are basically, you know, I sent Jim a text, right? So if he saw me on TV, he wouldn't say that so-and-so Rivers, right, was in the studio on Monday, right? And he had the nerve then telling him he's down here with his cave people, right?
I don't even know who he is.
What do you mean cave people?
People who agree with Pope Francis and Cardinal Dolan and my bishop, right, who have a certain philosophical perspective on marriage, right? So I'm down there with the cave people, right? So I get down there. It's sunny. It gets warm. And it was amazing to me, the politics in terms of the press coverage, right? So I get there, and then my cave people show up. And then they keep coming. And then there were 15,000 people, one black Pentecostal a minister from Brooklyn named Ruben Diaz, who's a flaming Democrat, but he's not, you know, he's with the cave people.
Right.
He brought 32 buses.
Wow.
That night.
Wow.
They rode all night. And see, these are my Holy Ghost Jesus jumping people, right? And they were fired up and ready to go, right? So they got there and we had this amazing confrontation, right? So we do the rally and we're singing. We're all church people. So, you know how we are. The people who move their lips when they read their Bible, right? Those kind of crude people, right? So my peeps, right? So we're all there. Then we march to the Supreme Court building. It was amazing. We march. We get. You'll love this. We get to the building. We turn a corner, and these guys are saying in Spanish, "One man, husband. One man, one wife." You know all that, right? And the rainbow, my rainbow brothers and sisters, they're there, right? And they could not believe what they saw. The line, 15,000 people took up like four blocks.
Yeah.
I mean, and I'm talking about Capitol Hill, blocks, right?
Right.
So almost 3/4 of a mile. And one guy ran up to me, right? Because it got really intense because they were shocked. They really didn't expect to see the Jesus people down there, right?
They didn't expect to see such a big crowd of anti-gay marriage people.
And what was interesting, if you read all of the press, no one cited attendance numbers. And it's fascinating when you read the times.
So the people outnumbered the non-cave people.
Exactly. So there was no number, right?
3-1?
Easy 3-1.
Really?
Right. And so what happens, we turn the corner and one guy says, "You're a pig!" Right? "You're a pig!" Right?
Really?
Yeah. I get it. You know, it's emotional. And they were shocked. Because, you know, the cave people came around the corner singing Jesus, you know those noxious people with that too much religion, right? You know,
don't
disgusting.
You, Gene, let me stop you there for a second. Don't you hate those kind of stories, though, when either side in any major debate picks one nut job, no matter who or she, as if he or she represents
I'm not
the pro-gay
that,
marriage
Jim, I'm
forces,
not doing
you know?
No, Jim.
Why
were
you there?
No.
Why
were
you there?
Okay, before I answer that
nutty.
Question.
That's why he was there.
No, really. Why'd you decide, I'm serious, to go down to Washington. That was the Prop 8 day. And obviously DOMA was the oral argument the next day.
Yeah.
Why'd you decide? I mean this seriously. It was important for you to physically be there.
For me, it's a philosophic position. It's a worldview question, which most people aren't going to have a debate about. Because it's all politics now, right? And so it's something I believe. I don't force it. 90% of the work I've done in this town has never been about that. You don't see me running around here with the religious crazies. They scare me, right? The hard right wing. No, actually, let me make an interesting point, though, on what you just said about using using as an anecdote, right? The one example, isolated example. You know what was amazing? There was another guy there who was on the opposition who was the most gracious guy. And we bonded, literally, in a moment where the guy jumps out, "You're a pig!" And he starts pushing. And he got physical. That guy, who was on the other side, says, "You can't do that." He was so gracious. And it was so classy. And actually, it was sort of like the best of America in this little nano moment, right? Because he said, no. We're not going to do that. We disagree. And we're not going to do it.
How about Gene Rivers if we just take it out of the, if we just do, you know, marriage, civil ceremony, get married, civil ceremony, the churches do whatever they want. What's wrong with that?
Meaning in civil being same sex, heterosexual, whatever, but not touch on the church.
And you can marry in your particular church, you know, whom you want to.
Okay, so a couple of things. Number one, see, my position is all humans are created equal.
Uh-huh.
Right? That's right. We agree with that, right?
We do.
All right, that much so far.
I think
far,
we
right?
got there, yeah. We're there. We're there.
Now, my argument is all sexual practices are not. All humans are equal. All sexual practices are not.
Well, I don't know if
you
want to go there.
You forced it now.
Okay.
Because I never come on here with my saber rattling talk. I know I have a minority position. I'm the skunk at the party.
Yep.
Right?
All the time,
right?
Yeah.
And there is, on this issue, only one legitimate perspective.
About sexual practices being
No. About marriage.
About marriage.
There's only one credible. See, I want to take your point, Jim.
I want to go back to your point for a second, if I can. The foundations of what you're saying a minute ago, this is all political.
No.
I would say you couldn't be more wrong.
Okay.
What we have learned from the trends in the polls is it's not about politics at all. It's about the personal.
Absolutely.
What we have learned is it used to be all politics, and everybody had their back up against the wall on all sides.
Right.
You learn from these stunning trends.
Yes, that's true.
If you know somebody
who's
gay,
absolutely.
Like,
absolutely.
Or your son is gay, like
absolutely.
Rob Portman,
absolutely.
If you
that's
are
absolutely.
Young.
Here's the thing, Reverend Rivers.
I agree with that. That's absolutely true.
It's much easier to come out in Brookline, where I live, because most people are white, and it's a very progressive.
Sure.
It's not that easy to come out in Roxbury still.
I'll tell you something interesting, right? You know what? When the dust settles and we can have a more rational conversation about this business, we will find that people's differences of opinion could not be simply reduced to homophobia. Right now, if you take my position, you're just a homophobe. You're just some caveman, right, whose knuckles drag on the ground, and you're just an idiot, right? And that's sort of the easy, kind of Cliff Notes version of my position.
It's not true.
Okay. All right. No.
Can I tell you why you do that if I may, Gene? I don't mean to be picking issues with you constantly,
of course,
but I'll do it anyway.
Pick an issue?
Well, let me just say, before Barack Obama had his evolution, as he calls
which would be a flip-flop.
I didn't hear most people, maybe it would. I don't hear most people calling him a homophobe. That's number one.
Sure.
Number two, the tactic that I think a lot of people use, you know what it's analogous to?
Yeah.
It's when George Bush used to stand up and say during the war, you know, for those who want us to just cut and run.
Right.
And I'd look around the room and say, even those of us who oppose the war in Iraq, who's talking about
cutting and running? Right.
The same sort of situation here. People, there are homophobes who are part of the anti-gay marriage constituency.
Absolutely.
There are a huge percentage of people who oppose gay marriage who were nowhere near homophobes.
Absolutely.
For a variety of reasons, religious, age, culture, oppose it. So saying that what the pro-gay marriage forces do is brand the opponent as homophobes is sort of, it's more in the debate tactic than it is.
Jim, I'm not suggesting, listen, I'm not suggesting that every person that's on the opposing side of this reduces it. I'm saying that in the media coverage, right, once it's off to the Mises and in the media and in the spin cycle, there's no rational discourse. That's why I like listen to you people, right? Because it can actually be a rational discussion as opposed to the craziness.
So are you okay with civil marriage? I mean, with civil unions, as long as you don't call them marriage, are you okay with civil unions?
Yeah, I'll tell you what's complicated about the civil union business.
I was
for civil unions. Then I discovered that civil unions is not really what the folk wanted, because if you gave them civil unions, the next day they were on marriage.
But are you okay with civil unions?
My church has the position that marriage is and the thing that we defend. And that's, you know, that's what I'm with the Catholics.
I think we have to work on him a little bit more on this.
But just work on me. I'm an idiot, but I'm working on it.
What did you say we were thoughtful? How'd you describe
us?
What did you
say? Thoughtful.
We're thoughtful. Yes, smart people. I love you.
And I think Reverend Rivers can evolve.
You can? That's one of us. Reverend Rivers, it's a pleasure.
Bless you.
As always, see you next Monday at 1 o'clock.
Gene Rivers, co-founder of the 10-Point Coalition in Boston. He joins us every Monday at 1 o'clock. Thank you for being with us. Coming up, thank you for the Time magazine cover, which says gay marriage is over, right? It's already won. Thank you very much. Got a very fetching picture there. Coming up, a new poll shows Boston residents are divided on the idea of a casino at Suffolk Downs. We'll talk with the pollster who did that poll and ask you, are you on board for a destination resort casino in East Boston? You're listening to 89.7 WGBH.
German churches rely on taxes paid by parishioners. Turns out, there's some tax dodging going on, even on the holy days.
Cheating myself in church. You don't get a membership card or anything, so that makes it easy. Do I feel guilty? No, not really.
I don't know. Somebody might be watching. I'm Kai Rizdahl. That story next time on Marketplace. We'll have the numbers from Wall Street as well. It's from APM.
Tonight at 6 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And White Oak Cottages at Fox Hill Village in Westwood, providing assisted living care for those with Alzheimer's and dementia in a family home environment with 12 private bedrooms. WhiteOakCottages.com.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. And casinos, three of them probably, are coming to Massachusetts. One might come to Suffolk Downs. But there's a headline in the Boston Globe. It says, residents divided on casino at Suffolk Downs. The reason that headline exists is because of the work of this guy from the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. He would be Andrew Smith. Hey, Andy, how are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. How are you?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for joining us, Andy. So what did your poll tell us about voter sentiment on the casino?
Well, we first ask about Boston residents' support for casinos in general in Massachusetts. And here we find that support and opposition is pretty well divided. 24% strongly support, 21% support somewhat, but 25% strongly oppose and 15% oppose somewhat. When you focus it on just having a casino at Suffolk Downs in East Boston, which is the major one that I think has been talked about over on the east side, you again still see that divided support, a little bit more opposition. 25% strongly support, 28% strongly oppose. 19% support somewhat, only 9% oppose somewhat. So sentiment is divided on this. And I think that's going to be the interesting thing going forward, is that in other states where casino referenda have come up for ballots, the opposition typically shows up at the polls on election day. It's harder to get the supporters out, because supporters of gambling, what we've seen in other states, is that they tend to say, yeah, casino sounds good, I'd like to have one of those if I want to go to it, whereas the opponents are really strongly opposed to it.
Andrew Smith, I also found it fascinating that your poll found there's differences in gender and also in socioeconomic levels. What's that about?
Well, again, that's not unusual. People with higher levels of education typically are more opposed to casino gambling than our lower educated, lower income people. It tends to be a blue collar gambling tends to be a blue collar occupation.
Why?
Or a blue collar recreation. Why? I think that you'd have to get into the why people who are at lower levels of income buy lottery tickets rather than people with high levels of income, or the same thing with levels of education. I think people, I don't have the data for this, but my suspicion is that people with higher levels of education understand the odds a little bit better, that the house always does win.
But by the way, the numbers are there. Years ago, there was a study done by a Senate committee, the post-audit and something in the state Senate, and the highest per capita playing of the lottery in Massachusetts were in two of the poorest communities, Chelsea and Holyoke, and in places like Dover and Weston, which, by the way, shared in some of the revenue from this, virtually nobody was playing.
It would also was related to jobs, Andy Smith, that many of the people that might be voting in East Boston and were really enthusiastic about the casinos, maybe they're out of work and they're looking for jobs.
Well, that's one of the interesting things about it. But when we look at this by neighborhood, it's difficult to say specifically about East Boston and how many people would support or oppose it there. In our sample, we only had about 30 people from East who lived in East Boston. But even if you look at East Boston, 39% of the residents that we spoke to said they strongly opposed it. Only 24% strongly support it. So I don't think they're seeing this as necessarily a big job creator, even in the backyard of East Boston.
By the way, we should say, for those who don't know, part of the casino law that passed the legislature requires the host community, once a deal is struck, to vote yes or no casino happens. Then the issue becomes, if you're in a major city like Boston, is it just the ward in which the casino would be, namely in East Boston, or is it citywide? That's a decision that will be made by the city council and the mayor here. You know, you mentioned that those who are most passionate, who come out in these referenda, are those who oppose. But on the flip side of that, there's a Lead Globe editorial today: casino referendums need voluntary spending limits. The numbers are staggering. They talk about the company behind the Suffolk Downs proposal. The company has spent nearly $1 million on its campaign already, and the No Eastie Casino, which is the lead organization on the other side, has $259 in cash contributions. The quote from the editorial, less than what casino supporters reported spending just on balloons. So the question, Andy Smith, is despite the fervor of the opponents in most casino debates, money, a lot of money in the differential, can clearly win an outcome. Can it not in these kind of things?
I don't know if it could win an outcome, but it certainly makes that playing field a whole lot more level for the casinos, or unlevel for the opponents. Again, that's going to be the big question. There's so many things that go into how a referenda is decided. If it's a citywide referenda, I think it's probably better for the casinos because you get more people that aren't as impacted negatively by some of the downside. But it also depends on whether it's in a general election or in a special election or maybe during a primary election.
In terms of turnout, you mean, obviously.
In terms of the turnout, and see who can get out there. You saw what happened in Foxborough a year ago. There was an unusual thing there where you saw the casinos had a lot of money, but the opponents were more strongly organized.
And while there was no referendum, I'm sorry, while there wasn't a referendum in Foxborough, specifically on casinos, the referendum through the back door was the selection of city council members there, and the city council members who were opposed to casinos won the majority, and ultimately Steve Wynn and Mr. Kraft, as he's called in this town, otherwise known as Bob Kraft, decided to withdraw the proposal. Hey, Andy Smith from UNH Survey Center, before we let you go, and by the way, if people want to weigh in on this at 877-301-8970, would you want a casino in your backyard? You
no, know, nobody wants it in their backyard.
Well, some communities in southeastern Mass, your old stomping grounds do.
Well, that's because there's a lot of poverty in Fall River, but I don't think anybody wants it in their backyard. They want it at the edge of town, Jim.
Is there a message that comes out of your poll, Andy, for both sides? Is there a lesson in this that the pros and the cons should take away?
Well, I think the pros, the people that are in favor of casinos, I think are going to have the money behind them, and they're going to be able to convince enough people who are marginally interested in going to a casino to vote for it. And I think that's why a citywide referendum would be better for them, and I think that's the takeaway for them. But if you really wanted to, if you were opposed to this, you'd probably want to concentrate your efforts on making this an East Boston-only referenda, and I think you'd do all you could to just let people in East Boston know what the potential downsides are to the casino. So depending on how you strategically go about deciding where it's going to be and when the referenda is going to be held in a general election or a special election, you got a lot of different things going on. The one thing that I would say is it's going to be difficult to go against the casino organizations. Don't bet against the house.
Beautifully put,
Andy.
Smith,
one last question for me. Why do men like casinos more than women?
Why do men gamble on anything more than women? I think that's just maybe our risky nature.
Genetics.
Yeah, because I found that fascinating.
Blame
too,
it
that
on
men
genetics.
Men were more in favor of this than women. Maybe women have seen more destruction from the gambling. I don't know. Andy Smith, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. Andy Smith is an associate professor of political science at UNH and director of the UNH Survey Center and does a lot of great polls.
For the Globe, yeah. 877-301-8970. Are you a not-in-my-backyard NIMBY kind of person? You know what's interesting about what Andy Smith said, which I'd never thought about before? He said the opponents would probably be happier with an East Boston-only vote. But what's interesting is Tom Menino is a big advocate for the casino coming to Suffolk. And he is one who said he only wants the vote to be in East Boston, which sort of runs afoul of Andy Smith's notion. And Andy Smith's notion makes sense to me.
I think you mentioned this before, but if you didn't, I just found it staggering when I read this, that Suffolk Downs people have already spent $1 million just on the ads. I mean, that
leaflets, flyers, all that sort of stuff.
That is huge. So where do the opponents get that kind of money?
Well, they have $259. That's plenty. 877-301-8970. I interviewed, before we get to the calls, a couple of years ago, Gary Loveman, who's the head of Caesars, which is involved in one of these things. And at the end of the interview, he was one of the most powerful advocates of casinos, the most eloquent advocates I've ever heard.
Uh-huh.
At the end, I asked the obvious question, would you want a casino in your hometown? What do you think he said?
No.
Of course not. Let's go to Frank. I don't know where you're from, Frank, but it's a pleasure to talk to you. You're on Boston Public Radio. Welcome.
Good morning.
Hi, Frank.
I'm from East Fine.
Hey, Frank.
And I'm fine.
Good.
And I'm calling regarding the Mashpee Wampanoag Casino out here.
Oh, that's right.
I'm not a NIMBY. I'm a NIMFY.
What does that mean?
In my front yard. Not in my front yard. Because I'll be able to look out of my 8x5 living room window and see the entire complex within an eighth of a mile of my home.
Ah.
Now you're discussing moneyed interest. Before our referendum, we had a political action committee called Together for Taunton. And they were paid for and funded by the tribe to the tune of either $500,000 or $800,000. I'm not sure. And they just steamrolled us. We filed a committee also, and I think our budget was something like $1,250.
Oh, Frank.
Well, that's why the Globe, by the way, is calling for – I should have made this clear before. In their lead editorial, they're calling for voluntary spending limits, obviously not legally mandated, but voluntary spending limits so that there can't be that kind of imbalance like there was where you are, Frank, and like there is already in East Boston. Sure. Frank, thank you so much for the call. 877-301-8970 is our phone number. You know, it's one of these things, you wonder if people are having buyer's remorse in Massachusetts. In fairness, and I'm anti-casino, at least in the state, overwhelmingly, 60%, high 50s, people supported casinos at the time that Val Patrick was moving this thing through the legislature. But you wonder, now that it's becoming a reality, did you see what happened the other day with Suffolk? People who had 20% of the financial interest in the proposal pulled out of the deal. Why? Because they didn't want to go through the background checks that were required by the Gaming Commission. Now, does that not tell you something?
Well, that's a little problematic. But I think to many people's minds who don't live right next to Suffolk Downs in East Boston, you think, well, there's this massive racetrack already there. There's all the parking lots are already there, so it's not going to make that much of a difference. The site for the Wynn Casino in Everett, is, again, it's on the Mystic. It's in an industrial kind of area. Look online at these Wynn Casinos out in Las Vegas. It's unbelievable. Everything seems to be floating on water, the tables and the chairs and everything else. They're very swank and swish, Jim.
Let's squeeze one more in. Pete, you're in Newport, Rhode Island. You're next with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Pete.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I wanted you to consider what happened in Rhode Island. We've had flat powers for 10 or 15 years, and they tried to change them over to full casinos. Now, for a slot changeover, there had to be two things to happen. One, all the people in the state had to vote positive. And the second was the people in the community where the slot parlor would be, that was going to be changed over, had to agree.
Mm-hmm.
Newport decided against it. One up in, north of Providence. I don't know the name of it.
Twin Rivers?
That one voted positive for it.
Right. They expanded from just slots to a full casino. That was this past November's election.
Yeah. Now, Newport didn't accept that, voted against the changeover. And that doesn't seem to be part of the discussion that you guys are having in the state of Massachusetts.
Well, I think there's only one slot parlor allowed in the state of Massachusetts.
There is one.
So that's, we don't have more than one. What do you think of gambling? How do you think it's worked down in Rhode Island? You're living there. You're living next to these casinos. What do you think?
I haven't been in the casino in Newport yet. I've been a resident all my life. I think it's a sucker's game.
Yeah.
By definition, it is a sucker's game. Obviously, the only way they make money and the state prospers is if people lose money. That's how it works.
There's huge unemployment in Rhode Island. Do you think it's helped the economy there or hurt or neither?
I don't think it's helped. I think you take money from some people and give it to other people, and most of that money ends up going out of state. So I don't think it's helped much. What it has done is it caused the legislature here to count on the gambling, and that in turn the whole tone to the argument. Now the argument is, what happens if we lose our gambling fund?
Pete, that's absolutely true. I mean, and thank you for the call. That's one of the big objections, is that when you go into you get in bed with these casinos, then you're relying on these casinos to generate a certain amount of money for taxes, and it doesn't always work out. And that's my big fear in Massachusetts, frankly, because a lot of these casinos have not done very well. Anyway, that is it for Casino Talk today. We were talking with Andrew Smith, who just did the poll for the Boston Globe, on the casino situation in Boston. He's an associate professor of political science at UNH. Up next, I have fooled Jim Browdy 3 times in 3 hours here on April Fool's Day. I do it every year. We're going to talk a little bit about the history of April Fool's Day. Up next with Edgar B. Herwick III. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH.
Dr. Samson Davis grew up on the tough streets of Newark, New Jersey. But in his new book, he says med school wasn't a ticket out of town, but a way to come back and help out. And he hopes he can inspire others to follow his lead. Living and dying in Brick City. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Brain Injury Association of Massachusetts, celebrating 30 years of prevention and support for survivors of brain injury and their families. BIAMA.org. That's BIAMA.org. And Kind-Hearted Woman, Frontline and Independent Lens present a film by David Sutherland. Follow one Sioux woman seeking to overcome abuse and heal her family. Kind-Hearted Woman begins Monday at 9 on WGBH 2.
There's no exception.
Marjorie Egan is singing that song to me, apparently. It is Boston Public Radio. It is April 1st, April Fool's Day. And my theory on this is April Fool's Day is for children, for childlike adults, and for Marjorie Egan.
Or joining us, for people who get taken by those childlike adults over and over and over again. Not naming any names or anything like that.
It's only three times in 3 hours. By the way, and we're joined by Edward B. Herrick III, who is our colleague and who's going to give us some background. I should just say, when the day started, Edgar, before Marjorie was here, you and two of our colleagues were sitting here, and I was saying every year I've worked with Marjorie, I have been the victim of an April Fool's joke, and I was rather embarrassed, and I thought it was rather puerile on her part to even be doing it. And then she comes in about 3 minutes after. She lays one on me. I fall for it. 10 minutes later, a second. This is totally true, everybody. And 10 minutes later, a third. Three for
right under
three.
Our noses.
Three
it's beautiful.
Three.
It's astounding. Marjorie, that's magical what you're doing.
Magical.
It's magical is the only
word
to
describe it.
Where'd
this all come from, this
well,
April Fool's
joke? You know, it's
deal.
Interesting because it's one of those things that nobody really knows. There's a number of theories out there. The one that most often gets cited is the change in 1582. Pope Gregory decided we're going to the Gregorian calendar.
Mm-hmm.
Up until that point, the new years happened at the spring equinox. So it happened around March 25th of every year, right? And so France was one of the countries that said, all right, we're going to do it. We're going to go to the Gregorian calendar, and the new year is now going to start in January rather than around springtime. So people in Paris and large cities in France, they got the message. They heard we're changing the calendar. But people in the countryside all over France, they hadn't heard about that yet. They were country bumpkins. They were backward people. And they continued to celebrate the new year around March 25th for a number of days, culminating in a big celebration on April 1st. So they're celebrating the new year on April 1st. And everybody in the city looked at those backward country folk and they said, you guys are just April fools.
That's pretty good, actually.
So it's probably not true. But that's the one that most scholars sort of look at and point to. There are a bunch of other theories out there as well. But in all honesty, it probably did really sort of spring out of a number of festivals that happened around the spring equinox. And typically back in the day when they would celebrate, they'd celebrate for 10 days, 12 days. And there would be a lot of celebrations. In particular, there was one called the Day of Hilarity, which happened, the Festival of Hilaria in Rome, which happened right around April Fool's Day. And this was part of their New Year's celebration and things like that.
So Marjorie, before she got to work this morning, texted me and say, let the Festival of Hilaria begin. Our number is 877-301-8970. If you've got some pathetic prank that you've pulled, but if there's a really good one that you either pulled on April 1st or you pulled on or someone pulled on you, give us a buzz. 877-301-8970. What's an historic prank or two that really belong in the annals of April Fool's pranks?
We'll go there in a second, but let's go real historic. Interestingly, even though the France story is probably apocryphal, there is still a holdover in France in the way they celebrate April Fool's that does harken back to the fact that it was a New Year's celebration. One of the things they did around New Year's was they would give each other gifts, especially food. And it was a Catholic country, and oftentimes the food that they were giving around this time of year, because it was around Lent, was fish. And that's still holds true in France. Today, we talked with one of our colleagues from The World here, and she told us a little bit about this, the way they celebrate in France on April Fool's Day.
I grew up in France. I grew up in Burgundy, but all over France on April Fool's Day, the fun trick is to try to tape a paper fish on the back of someone without them knowing it. And then, of course, this person will go around all day without knowing it, and everybody's sort of like, you know, chuckling in their back. That's a trick that, you know, children prepare for, like for an entire week. They might just, in school, cut and design really elaborate fishes and then just run after their mother and father and just tap you in the back. And, hey, how you doing? You know, all of a sudden, you got a fish on your back. Poisson d'avril. Poisson d'avril means April's fish.
Now, Edgar, you don't know Marjorie as well as I do.
So inspired.
The notion that Marjorie will not try taping a fish to my back next year.
And Jim, none of us are going to tell you if it happens. I'm sorry. I'm just letting you know. None of us are going to tell you.
That's great.
Isn't that great?
I love it. Yes.
Okay. So one of my favorites, this is probably the first known use of television as a medium to pull an April Fool's joke. And this is at the BBC, right, in England. And they've got a long tradition of really great hoaxes that they've done at the BBC. But this one's from 1957, okay? They run a documentary about a bumper crop in the spaghetti plant, a bumper spaghetti crop after a particular spring. We have a clip. This was a television broadcast. We have a clip from some of this. You got to listen to this. This is unbelievable.
The past winter, one of the mildest in living memory, has resulted in an exceptionally heavy spaghetti crop. Spaghetti cultivation here in Switzerland is not, of course, carried out on anything like the tremendous scale of the Italian industry. Many of you, I'm sure, will have seen pictures of the vast spaghetti plantations in the Po Valley. For the Swiss, however, it tends to be more of a family affair. After picking, the spaghetti is laid out to dry in the warm Alps.
And over this video, they're showing them, they're pulling spaghetti out of trees, laying it out. It's amazing. We're going to have this up online at WGBHnews.org a little later at the Curiosity Desk. You can check it out. We'll have this video up online.
What do you think is the psyche? Well, why am I asking you? I should ask Marjorie.
Yeah.
Why do you get such satisfaction out of this pranking of me you do every single year?
Because my mother did it every year. I mean, I remember times when she would say, run up to Gotta get out of bed. The cellar's flooded, and we all come flying out of bed at 6:30 in the morning.
I'll tell you, it doesn't get much better than that.
Wasn't flooded, so it's sort of that. I feel in her memory, I have to keep this up every year.
Let's go to Marble Harbor. Andrea is on the phone, and I don't know if you can top the spaghetti crop, Andrea, but do the best you can. Welcome, Andrea.
Hi, I'm so glad you guys are back on the air.
Thank you.
Love the two of you together.
Thank you.
Well, I did call. I didn't hear it because I was waiting, but probably 25, 30 years ago, it was on the evening news on April 1st about these old Italian grandmas with their babushkas with scythes out in the field, cutting down spaghetti. And the station was
it's so good.
The station was absolutely flooded with people calling and saying, where can I get spaghetti seeds? Where can I get that?
Spaghetti I want to plant them in my garden.
I still remember it all these years, and every April 1st, I just think of that video. And it was one of the Boston TV stations, unless I was still living in Chicago then. I really can't remember. Time goes by. But it was just the funniest thing. Everybody wanted to plant spaghetti in their garden.
And Andrew, you described it beautifully. Thank you so much for the call. We appreciate
the call. Okay, what's some more famous ones?
Let's stick with the BBC. Again, more recently, they did
one. I love
the
BBC.
This is just a couple of years ago, right? So they circulate this video, and they say that the film crew was out doing one of their shows, one of these nature shows that they do so well, right? The Miracles of Evolution. And they happened to catch something that they had never seen before.
This recently discovered colony of penguins is unlike any other. They don't need to huddle together every winter for protection against the bitter cold, because these little fellas can do something no other penguins can.
Listen to this music swell. And the penguins all go flying. And this video looks amazing. Like, you're like, what is happening? These penguins are flying up. They show them up through the air, flying out over the rainforest.
Oh, my God.
And the BBC, again, got flooded. People were like nuts. They put it up on YouTube. It had millions and millions of views. And then eventually they relented. And a few days later, they put out another video, which sort of did the showing how they kind of did this and how they mocked this up. We'll have this video up as well. But when you see this, it really looks like they're flying.
You have to be very careful about this kind of thing because it's one thing to do a crop of spaghetti or flying penguins, but there have been some instances where people have had April Fool's jokes, which sort of cost them their jobs.
Well, there's one in this town that we could talk about in a second. Our number is 877-301-8970. I want to defend myself before Edgar continues, though. Now, Marjorie, if you, for example, produced a video of flying penguins, you know what I'd say? I'd say, good for you, Marjorie. That's an excellent prank. But when I walk in the studio 5 minutes before we're about to go on air, and Marjorie says, you will not believe this. Reverend Rivers just canceled his 1 o'clock appointment. We've got nothing to fill that spot. And I start bad-mouthing Reverend Rivers for giving us such that's childish, Marjorie. That's just not quite penguin ready.
You know, Jim, you see yourself as a man of some intelligence, and incisive
some
interviewing.
Insight, yes.
And every day you tell me what I should do and what I should ask. Mm-hmm. And so this is my little way to get back at you, Jim. That's what it's all about.
What else you got, Edgar? 877-301-8970. If you've got a great one, like the spaghetti one, we'll take it. What else do you have, Edgar?
Well, you were just mentioning the one that happened in this town, the pranksters extraordinaire Opie and Anthony, known for their pranks left and right, right? Well, they did one on April Fool's in 1998 at the expense of Mayor Menino. Let's hear a little bit of what they were doing that morning.
Ma'am, can you believe about Mayor Menino?
What, being in Florida?
Well, you haven't heard?
No.
He was in a horrible car crash today.
Oh, no, what happened?
Northern Florida. I guess he was driving to the airport to come back to Boston, and he was in an accident.
Are you kidding?
No, head-on collision.
My brother just woke me up and said the mayor of Boston's dead?
Yeah, head-on collision.
Wow.
All right, bro?
All right, man.
I guess we'll find out more soon.
Now, first of all, just if you just tuned in 10 seconds ago, that was not true. That was a prank 15 years ago by Opie and Anthony, for which they got fired. I have to say, I found that so unbelievably unfunny at the time. I didn't hear it, but I heard about it.
People
I heard
dying
about it,
like, in car crashes
funny about
is
that?
Not an April Fool's joke.
No, I mean, saying I have egg salad on my nose like you did this morning, that is moderately
funny. She pulls like 15 jokes and you fall for 15 times in one morning, Jim.
I can't even
one morning.
By the way,
it's April 1st.
For those who think I'm literally 3 in 3 hours, the first we can't mention on the air, unfortunately, was the cruelest and the lowest.
Which
and
happened
the most
right
successful.
Under our noses. We're all working away in our cubes and Jim pops up 3 minutes after warning us, by the way. 3 minutes after warning us that she gets him every year. And he's like, she just got me. We're like, she just got you, radio.
He was incensed, too. He was fit to be tied. The steam was coming out of his ears.
Thank you, Edgar. David in Holliston, you're with Ed. Edgar, Jim, and Marjorie, we're talking about April Fools. Hey, David.
Hey, guys. I was a bad dad this morning.
What'd you do?
I got my 6-year-old son, TJ, with the classic elastic around the kitchen sink sprayer.
That's great.
He was devastated. He just looked terrified, confused, spraying all over the floor, and then started crying. It was so bad.
Now, are you embarrassed you did this to a 6-year-old who happens to be related to you, David, or no?
Terribly, terribly.
I can tell. David, thank you so much.
He's never
going
to get over it. The poor kid will be in therapy forever, blaming this April Fool's Day 2013 for all his problems.
I hate to make this all about Marjorie. Is after during one of the breaks during the show, Edgar, before you came in, she literally, tell me if this is not true, after she's done 3 out of 3 for me, she says, I got to start figuring out what to do with my kids. And she's got 3 kids, all of whom are grown, none of whom are 6, and she's plotting.
I'm planning the attacks right now.
Very nice.
Let's try one more here. Penny and Seekonk, you're with Edgar, Jim, and Marjorie on April Fool's Day. Hey, Penny.
Hi there.
Hi.
Mine is, I don't know that it was exactly April Fool's, but if the guy was born on April 1, it was perfect. It was a birthday party, and the wife of the birthday boy called all their friends and set it up. We're going to do a surprise party, but now you must invite another couple that we don't know at all. And so everyone did. When the time came before he got home, all the people that he knew hid in the back of the house. All the people that he had never seen in his life were sitting in the front room. He walked in, they all screamed, happy birthday, Mark!
That's pretty good.
And he's stunned. He says, not even trees in the right house.
That's a good one.
That's a good one, Penny.
Good.
Thank you. You got any more, Edgar?
I mean, there are so many good ones. Of course, there was a famous one where NPR... on Talk of the Nation.
I did not know
one. They did a hoax in 1992 at John Hockenberry, who's with The Takeaway now. He said that Richard Nixon was going to run for president again. And he got Rich Little to help him out. And Rich Little did a bunch of sound cuts.
As Richard Nixon
saying, I never did anything wrong and I won't do it again. And people bought it. People were flooding NPR with calls. So that's a good one.
That's a really good one. No one's hurt. No one died.
One I'd never heard of, which is great. 1985, George Plimpton, the great writer George Plimpton.
Paper Tiger.
For Sports Illustrated about a pitcher named Sid Finch who's coming up for the Mets who can throw 168-mile-per-hour fastball, which he learned not playing baseball but with Tibetan monks in the hills.
I remember it well. Hey, let's squeeze Henry and Weston in because he's got a great one. Henry, you're next with Jim, Marjorie, and Edgar. Go, Henry.
Yeah, I think one was in the newspaper. Taco Bell claimed to have bought the Liberty Bell.
That's right. Yeah.
And they were going to fix the crack.
The other one
was my wife came home all excited because she had heard about the exploding maple trees up in Vermont during the maple season. And I hope she's not listening, but she thought it was a true story and was sitting at dinner and she's telling me all about how this used to affect the Indians and you had to watch out for exploding trees.
Yeah.
And I finally said to her, dear, it's April 1st.
Oh, that's great.
Taco Bell buys Liberty Bell.
Yeah,
they're going to
really
fix
good.
The crack.
Another great food-related one in 98, the Burger King takes out a full-page ad in the USA Today introducing the left-handed Whopper.
Why am I laughing
at
these?
Start going into Burger King's. Can I get a left-handed Whopper?
Can I tell you, I am giving you my word now.
Yep.
It's 365 days before next April 1st. Marjorie will not get me even once.
Okay. All right.
Next April 1st.
We'll check
1st.
In every next year. I heard about the fish, Jim. I'm already designing my little fish to stick on
great.
Your back.
Well, okay. Thank all of you guys who joined us today. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can find us on the web at wgbhnews.org/BPR. Follow us on Twitter at Boss, B-O-S, Public Radio, and Facebook.com/BPR. Tomorrow at noon, John King. We're going to talk national politics. 1 o'clock, Republican Charlie Baker. We'll talk local politics. That's it for today, Edgar. Happy April 1st to you.
You too, Jim.
You didn't have anything planned for me, do you?
If I did, I'm not going to say it.
Exactly,
now.
You wouldn't. Look at the look on her face. This is really so...
Very, very happy
Jim,
April
you need
Fool's
to start
Day.
Plotting now
to
get Marjorie next year. That's our
did
mission.
Did I ever get you or I didn't?
No.
I didn't think
That's
so.
That's the mission.
I am Jim Browdy.
I'm Marjorie Egan. Thanks for tuning in.
See you tomorrow at noon.